Hello, and welcome to TwerpCast, episode 26, TrekCast, The Wrath of Fan. This time we'll be discussing the new J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie, and I'd like to introduce you to Cadet First Class, Executive Producer, James Caswell.
And he's Doug Zeitlin, Commander of the USS Twerp. No, wait, make that Captain. No, wait again, it's Commander. Where is he? Well, at least he's not a cadet anymore.
Also, please welcome back special correspondent, straight from the Altar Nebula, Ken Halloran. Well, as you may have guessed, we've just seen Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams universe.
If you follow this show at all, you know that about a year and a half ago, we sat down and talked about the original series of Star Trek and where this whole concept originated. And if you're really interested in finding out the history, we highly encourage you to go back and listen to TrekCast, the original series, which was episode 9 for us. So that was actually a little while ago.
Is that one of mine?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
This time, though, we're going to go directly into reviewing the movie, and we're going to start out by issuing a spoiler alert. We will not be held accountable for any secrets that we reveal. If you have not seen the movie and you don't want spoilers, come back and see us after you're done.
Or at least start listening, then. You don't actually have to look at us.
And if you haven't seen the movie yet, why?
Don't you know you're supposed to rush out and see it at the very first showing, like any good Trekker would? So, now that you've received your fair warning, on with TrekCast. Doug, opening thoughts.
First, you have to consider a couple of things. I'm a huge J.J. Abrams fan, so I'm already looking forward to this movie. Nemesis came out in 2002, so it's been 7 years since we've seen a Star Trek movie, and Enterprise was over in 2005, so it's 4 years since there's been any new Star Trek.
Save for shows like ours.
So my expectations were extremely high to begin with seeing this movie. That being said, there's only a couple of things that could happen. Is A, go to see the movie and I'm really disappointed. Or B, movie exceeds my expectations and I'm like, oh my god, this is the greatest movie ever. Now, I am one of those people who last year went into The Dark Knight with really high expectations. Wasn't let down, but I didn't think that it was as good as everybody else does.
You're entitled to be wrong.
Well, Jim, it's usually your job, so I'll take it on this one time. My overall thought on the movie as a Star Trek episode was closer to the disappointment side. I thought there were parts of the story that were a little weak. Overall, as a summer blockbuster movie, I really liked it. This is a movie I would go see again.
I think you did an excellent job of summing that up. As a summer blockbuster hit, it had all of the ingredients. It had action, it had some romance. It had a good, strong leading man, or in this case, leading men. It should do very, very well in the box office. And as a Star Trek fan, I'm very happy for that, because Star Trek needs a new shot in the arm to get people interested in again, so that in another 10 years or so, it doesn't just completely fade away because the fans have just dwindled off to nothing. Star Trek needs new fans to come in for it to survive. As a fan of Star Trek canon, there were a couple of holes here and there, but I wasn't nearly as disappointed as I expected to be, because a majority of the holes got filled in using the plot device of time travel has changed things. So from this point forward, stories told in this altered universe, and from this point forward I'll probably just refer to it as the Abrams universe, are going to be different than anything that we may have known as canon before.
Before I let Ken take on that, I just want to stress that even within the movie, they call this an alternate timeline. They didn't try and say, this is the old Star Trek. They let you know, all right, we realize history has changed, and this is not going to be the universe that Spock Prime witnessed as he was aging.
He didn't find a woman on the alien planet to fall in love with. I mean, the only one we saw him striking silly was the one green chick.
See, if the thing that was charging at him had held still for about 5 seconds, though...
I really enjoyed it. I think of the three of us, I probably actually enjoyed it the most. I also recognize that I'm probably the one of the three of us who's got the least amount of emotional attachment to the canon old universe. I'm the one who actually gave up partway through season 7 of Next Generation for the most part.
Star Trek The Next Generation was worth giving up partially through season 7.
I never got into DS9. I tried for a while, but I never really got into it. I actually gave Voyager a year and then gave up. I wasn't even able to tune into Enterprise, so that was never really an option. So, I mean, I don't have the same attachment. I know that I enjoyed the original series growing up when I caught the reruns on Channel 9, but I didn't catch it regularly, and I think you two probably caught it more often than I did.
Yeah, that's true. As far as like the Next Generation and post-Next Generation goes, although ultimately this movie probably negates a lot of what happened in the Next Generation.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the things I liked about it, is the fact that they said time travel has occurred, everything you know isn't for certain anymore, time has changed. I got the feeling they were intentionally saying, okay, here's the passing of the torch from the old continuity to the new continuity, as much as they were trying to pass the torch when they dropped a bridge on Kirk in the first of the Next Generation films.
What I really was trying to say is I didn't mind that at all. I don't think that continuity, the Next Generation and post-Next Generation, was really important to this Star Trek movie. What you're saying about the passing of the torch was exactly the important part, and that's what this movie is. We're giving it to the 21st century now.
That shot on the arm that Jim talked about.
My biggest problem wasn't in the disavowing of Star Trek canon or a lack of action adventure. My biggest problem was in what struck me as being a lack of common sense and or understanding of how military organizations work.
For what Jim is saying, I suggest checking out scifiwire.com. There's a little article in there called 11 Things in Star Trek That Made Us Go WTF. And there's a couple of them that I really agree with. Just talk about common sense. In particular, for me, what gave me the heebie-jeebies was the illogic of this young cadet is causing a problem. Let's put him in an escape pod and eject them to a lifeless planet. What happened to the brig? What happened to confined quarters? I mean, this just comes out of left field.
No, that's Spock's emotional side. Nobody noticed.
Yes, you're absolutely correct from the storyline, but it was just one of those things that was really deus ex machina, because Spock had to strand him on the lifeless planet, because that's where Spock Prime had also been stranded. So on this entire planet, they were put right next to each other.
There really are several instances of things that are put in strictly to help move the story along, no matter how little sense it would have made in real life. The idea of Cadet Kirk having one single successful mission and immediately going from cadet to captain, completely bypassing the ranks of ensign, lieutenant junior grade, lieutenant, lieutenant commander, commander. It would be like saying this rookie that just came in to A-ball, you hit 3 home runs in a game, therefore we're putting you in the World Series.
I don't disagree with your logic. However, it doesn't actually tell you how much time has passed between the successful completion of the mission and Kirk's promotion to captain. It was certainly a vague amount of time, very possibly implicit that it was immediate, but it didn't say that. You had Captain Pike in a chair, you had him with more aged makeup. I mean, there is a lot of evidence to show that this was at least some significant time after the successful mission.
And the other part of it is they had lost at least 7 ships, and we don't know how many more in whatever was going on that they sent all the cadets out in the first place. It was implicit that they had a manpower shortage.
Well, backing up for just a moment, Captain Pike is getting ready to leave the ship. He turns to his first officer, tells him, "You're in charge of the ship now." Spock takes over as captain. He then turns to this cadet who has no field experience and says, "You're going to be his first officer." Are you meaning to tell me that on a ship of hundreds of people, the only person qualified to take over as first officer is a cadet?
On a ship that was manned almost entirely by cadets, yes.
And then there's the other point that this captain happens to know the family history very well, knows that Kirk is a genius-level cadet, and can improvise things like winning the no-win scenario.
Likewise, I'm fully willing to admit that we're talking a fair bit of minutia here, and I promised myself that I wasn't going to be one of those Star Trek fans that goes through and nitpicks every iota of this movie.
Yeah, and you believed you?
But, you know, on the other hand, Jim, you have some very valid complaints. If Captain Pike tells you it takes 4 years to get through Starfleet Academy to become an officer, and Chekhov is an ensign at 17, that means he enlisted at age 13. That is a perfectly valid issue that you brought up.
That was definitely one of the other questions that came to mind. How soon do people start Starfleet in this version of the Federation?
It varies.
And actually, I thought about it. Wesley Crusher was probably around 13 or 14, actually, when he was taking Starfleet classes.
Yeah, but that was Wesley Crusher.
But who's to say that Ensign Pavel Chekov isn't an equally genius person? I mean, he is an ensign on the flagship of the Federation.
Mostly with that damned Beatles haircut that made me underestimate him. That was a monkey's haircut. Wanted him to look like Davy Jones.
But the fact that I have to get really nitpicky, minutia-detailed, in order to find things that I didn't like about this movie, I think that says something positive about the film.
Only one thing about the movie that really bothered me is I found that whole thing about young Kirk driving the car off the cliff to be completely extraneous, and it didn't add anything to the movie for me.
It lets you know his middle name is Tiberius.
I went in knowing that, and they actually kind of hinted at that in the naming scene with his parents.
If this time travel story negates Picard becoming captain of the Enterprise, that might really piss off Q. I mean, he could just undo the whole thing with a...
I believe that we actually now have a stable time loop, because in context of the story, at this point, we know James Kirk knows when Romulus' star is going to go supernova, which means the population of Romulus will be able to be evacuated in time, which means Nero will have no reason to go back in time, which will reset the other timeline, which means both timelines have to coexist.
I don't have a problem with that. I can live with alternate universes. That's been part of Star Trek for a really long time.
Yeah, we've had the Mirror Mirror universe since season 2 of the original series.
There's an episode of The Next Generation where Worf continually is traveling through all these different universes because he's displaced. He goes through some sort of time-space anomaly that has loosened him from time-space, and he keeps going from universe to universe to universe, and they end up showing like 200 Enterprises all in one scene.
Yeah, so parallel universes is not a foreign concept to Star Trek. We just need to accept the fact that for the foreseeable future, Star Trek movies are going to be telling the stories of what happens in this particular universe.
I like you calling it the Abrams universe. I don't have a problem with that.
I don't feel like we really need to worry about the designation, but okay.
Well, it's not Star Trek Prime. It's Star Trek Abrams.
But we are dealing with new actors taking on roles that were created by a previous generation. I know that a lot of people had concerns of, are they just going to be mimicking the original actors? Are they really going to make the parts their own? They didn't really know what to expect of these new actors. The question that I think we should answer next is, did the actors portray these characters well?
I truly think that really every one of these actors made the role their own. There's some that really stand out in my mind, but that has a lot to do with the amount of screen time they got. Chekov probably has only half a dozen lines in the whole movie.
It's Chekov. That's all he ever got in any movie.
I'm just saying that it's hard for him to distinguish himself from Walter Koenig because he wasn't given a lot. Ben Cross as Sarek, I thought he was incredible.
I think they did a great job. I had no problem accepting any of these actors as those characters at a younger stage of life than what I knew him.
I agree completely. Not only did they make the role their own, but they made you believe that these were the original characters. Carl Urban as Dr. McCoy. I didn't see an actor on the screen at all. I just saw Dr. McCoy.
He was probably one of the best of making you believe that this is the same ornery doctor that we saw for all those years.
I also really, really enjoyed Simon Pegg.
Simon Pegg, this crowd, him not going over well was an impossibility.
I really wish Scotty had had more screen time.
My biggest disappointment with Simon Pegg is we didn't see him in more of the movie.
Sulu was the guy who actually gave the word MILF to America.
What type of advanced combat training have you had?
I'm saying! Which was consistent with the old show.
I agree.
And it was useful.
One of the things I really like this movie is how well they told a serious story and still were able to get in the comic moments.
I'll top that by saying I liked how they used all of the pieces of dialogue that people were expecting and using them for comedic moments.
Green-blooded bastard.
Yeah, they included all of the pieces of dialogue that the fans would have been upset if they hadn't heard, but they also managed to use a majority of them for a laugh.
Well, that whole thing about when Chekov was reading their assignment and he's butchering his VW thing the whole time, more consistently than Koenig ever did. Actually, the one character who I think actually seemed the most different from how she'd appeared on the old show was Uhura. But that's because on the old show she just sort of sat there most of the time.
Which is actually excellent because it really developed her as a person rather than the answering machine.
I'm sorry to say this, but I think the person who was the most lacking was Eric Bana, the villain of the show.
I like Eric Bana. I liked him as the Incredible Hulk. Wasn't a terrific movie, but it wasn't a terrible movie.
Nero just came across as being very two-dimensional among a bunch of characters that were very three-dimensional.
I don't think there was any fault of Eric Bana's. I think that was the writing.
It was a plot device. He wasn't a character.
I guess that's what I felt was lacking. They needed another strong villain to start things out with.
I expected Eric Bana to be another con. And as far as, like, ruthlessness and single-mindedness, yeah, he embodied that.
But he didn't have the passion.
Yeah.
Nero is supposed to be a character out for vengeance. A character who has lost everything. He has nothing left to live for.
Wait, that sounds a lot like Khan.
But he just kind of sat in his throne captain's chair and occasionally stabbed people, and I didn't feel like he lost anything. It just sat there.
Oh my god, and he put the thought-controlling creatures in the captain's brain. He was Khan!
Yeah, he definitely was supposed to be a Khan-like figure, but it wasn't there.
Well, he was from the previous timeline. He's supposed to be a two-dimensional villain.
But again, like you said, that probably wasn't anything to do with Eric Bana. I do believe that a lot of it had to do with the writing.
Part of it was the fact that he didn't have a whole lot of screen time. It's an ensemble show. They were trying to establish 7 or 8 principal characters.
That would be coming back in the next movie.
Somebody had to get the short end of the stick, and it was the bad guy.
My question now is, can, like, Spock Prime go find young Carol Marcus, get her to create a new Genesis device to recreate Vulcan?
You know, that's actually a pretty good idea. It might take 30 years, but it might work.
Wouldn't it just be as easy to find a uninhabited Class M planet, move everybody there, and call it New Vulcan?
But not nearly as fun.
And not nearly as likely to have disastrous consequences, like the new planet going BOOM! So the ongoing debate before the movie came out was, is this a reboot or is this a sequel? And I think we can say, in all honesty, it was both.
What does it really matter is my question. I mean, you look at a show like Casino Royale. I really don't know any James Bond fan, and there's 3 of them in the recording session right now, that was upset that they started the franchise over.
No, not at all.
No. And, you know, I wasn't overly impressed by Quantum of Solace as an independent movie flick, but if you look at it as part 2 of Casino Royale and watch them back to back, it makes a much better movie. To answer my own question, I don't think it really matters. I like the original Star Trek. I like the Next Generation. I like the dumb cartoons. It was all fun to me.
I agree with Doug. I don't think it matters.
If you call yourself a fan of science fiction and a fan of these characters, there is no reason why you should not be able to enjoy this film. If you're a rules monger who is anal retentive about Star Trek continuity and it has to be canon or else it just doesn't count,
or the tech has to be exactly right as it was 50 years ago. I know somebody like that who gave up on this new one without ever seeing it just because the tech is different.
Yeah, you need help. You really need some serious help. You need to either get out and get yourself a life or just bottle yourself up in your basement with your original series DVDs or Blu-rays and just stay out of everybody else's way.
Or remember one thing. It's just a TV show!
The more modern phenomenon with Star Trek is each micro-generation has chosen a show, this is only Star Trek. You have the original Trekkers who, like, only the original series is canon. You got people who came in just on the Next Generation. Only the Next Generation is real Star Trek. And there are people who think that only Voyager, that piece of crap, is the only good Star Trek. And if you're a real Trekker, it's all Star Trek, and some of it's good, and some of it's bad. There are incredibly bad episodes of the original series. Spectre of the Gun.
Spock's Brain.
Oh my god. And even though I absolutely hate Voyager, I don't even want to recognize it happened, there was a couple of really good episodes in that show. Only 2, but there were a couple of really good episodes in that show.
I'll be honest, the first 2 seasons of Next Generation were a little on the painful side, and we've already heard my commentary on the 7th season of it. Masks. Oh, God, I hate it. I think that was the one that...
God, that's one of the worst episodes of all time.
I think that was when I finally said, enough, and turned it off and didn't turn it on again until All Good Things.
If you watch this movie and you go, you know what, I didn't enjoy it...
Damn it, those shirts weren't velour!
If you're taking that attitude, you need to readjust yourself. If you look at it and you go, you know what, I'm not that much into action, and this has a lot more action to it than previous Star Trek movies and episodes had, you know, that's not what I'm into, so I didn't really enjoy it that much. Okay, you're entitled to your opinion. But if the reason you don't like it is because the velour wasn't there, or because there weren't enough jelly beans on the controls...
Or Kirk didn't get enough piece of the action, if you know what I mean.
Or, and this one really blew my mind, they said that the teleporter beams didn't look right. How on earth do we know what a teleporter beam looks like?
That's actually one of my favorite new additions. I really like the new effect.
They're closer to reality now.
Likewise, if you saw the movie and you decide that you didn't like it, okay, fine. If you refused to see the movie because you automatically assumed it was going to be bad because it wasn't your Kirk and your Spock and your Dr. McCoy...
Then that is your right, and just don't talk to us. Now, the other thing I will say about this is Star Trek is it was a lot less cerebral than the best Star Trek. Star Trek at its best got kind of cerebral.
And that's why it got two pilots, because the first pilot was really, really good. It just was incredibly cerebral.
Yeah, there is the marketing to those of us on the far side of the bell curve, and then there's marketing it so it'll sell.
Talking about selling Star Trek, this movie had so much promotion material, advertising through other corporate sponsors, newspaper articles, appearances on the talk show circuit, heavy TV ads. This thing was just promoted through the roof. And it raised the question in my mind of, if Paramount had put half of the resources into any of the other Star Trek movies, would they have been more popular because they were reaching out to a broader audience? This movie was made specifically to reach out to a wider audience. They didn't want just the Star Trek fans to be showing up to this film. They wanted to reach out and grab a whole new batch of fans. And therefore, they've done things like marketing with Burger King and Esurance and Mattel and Pez and all of these other corporations to draw more people in. If Paramount had given even half of that amount of effort to, say, Nemesis, would it have done better in the box office?
No. Nemesis was a piece of crap. But yes, to your basic point. Nemesis was intrinsically written for the fans. If you didn't see Star Trek The Next Generation, there's almost no possibility you could understand that movie.
The attitude that Paramount had is they had an hour-long ad on every week. Every time you turned on Star Trek, the idea was there was your ad for Star Trek the movie.
That appears to be the exact tactic they were using. They have a built-in audience. They know exactly how many people are watching the television show every week from the Nielsen ratings, and they could pull those people out of their couches and into the movie theaters. If they had taken on a, let's make a movie that anyone can see, something like Star Trek IV, and then market it, they would have sold a ton more tickets. Star Trek First Contact is a very accessible science fiction action flick. If that had been promoted as much as this movie, we would still be watching Next Generation movies.
Oh, and for the record, Star Trek Nemesis may have been written for the fans, but it also slapped the fans right across the face, too.
Well, that was Paramount's attitude in those days. They still had Berman working for them.
The thing that has always boggled my mind about that is that movie was written by a Star Trek fan for Star Trek fans, and it seemed like maybe he had never watched the show before.
No, it's called executive meddling. If we could see what he wrote versus what they ended up having to film because of what the executives wanted.
Nemesis had the opportunity of being a really good, fun movie. You'd need to cut about half of it out, but it could have been a good TV episode.
It could have been a good movie. They would have needed to add a few things and cut out that whole damn B4 thing, and maybe gotten a villain in there who was actually charismatic.
Patrick Stewart played young Patrick Stewart at X-Men 3, showing that technologically, a little bit of CGI in the real actor can look much younger.
This film was geared for general audiences. It wasn't geared for Trek fans per se. It wasn't designed to alienate them like some other films we've already mentioned. It was geared so people like your mom could go see it and enjoy it.
She wants to see it again.
My niece came with us to see this film, and she really enjoyed it. In the end, that's what this movie was supposed to do. It was supposed to bring in new fans. It was supposed to bring in people who either hadn't seen it before because they could never get past all the canon, or because they just didn't see it as being cool, or they weren't alive then. The whole purpose of this was to bring in new fans, to reinvigorate. And I think it did a wonderful job at that. My niece walked out going, "That was great! Let's see it again!"
As Ken said, this was meant for a general audience, and not only did it not alienate the original fans, but it actually had a lot of stuff in there. Call them Easter eggs if you want. That was for us, that we got, that even though they missed it, didn't hurt the movie for them.
Yeah.
I love seeing Scotty owning a Tribble. That was hilarious. And also, actually, just more than Star Trek fans, actually for J.J. Abrams fans in the bar, Uhura orders a slusho, which is the drink that was invented for Cloverfield. The company that the main character was going to work for in Japan was slusho. Again, if you didn't know it, you didn't miss anything. But if you're a J.J. Abrams fan, there's a little Easter egg for you.
You have the question, does Paramount care if they alienate their longtime fans? And the answer is yes, I think they are concerned about it, because I think they made a point of trying to avoid it.
One of their marketing ploys was putting into their commercials, "This is not your father's Star Trek." When I initially saw that in the advertising, I really was put off by it. Like there was something wrong with your father's Star Trek.
I have to disagree on two accounts. I saw it with my father. He liked it. It is his Star Trek. And I'm going to take my daughter to it. If she likes it, it will be her father's Star Trek. So I have a problem with that.
Cassie's your niece, but you really are her father figure, so there is that. And I saw it with my dad, and he enjoyed this Star Trek more than he's enjoyed any of the films. And then again, he was never really into the original Trek. He didn't get into the Trek until Next Generation. And then there's the other father I could mention, the fact that I've got a priest who's a Trekkie, which I think is great. That is the coolest thing, having a priest who's a Trekkie.
It is your father's Star Trek.
Actually, he's a Monsignor. It's a slightly higher rank than father, but that's getting into Catholic minutia.
So I think it's a bit egotistical of them to say, this isn't your father's Star Trek. This isn't like anything that's come before. We've kind of established already that it is like things that have come before. Nero is like Khan. That doesn't negate the fact that we can enjoy it. The fact that we enjoyed this doesn't negate the fact that we liked the original stuff.
It's a little different, but that's okay, because you can like vanilla, but 40 years of vanilla is going to get real tiring.
We've had vanilla, we've had chocolate.
We've had the mint and chocolate chip, and now that we're done with discussing Kirk's sex life,
now it's time for some butter pecan. It's like vanilla, only a little nuttier.
So where does that leave Star Trek to go?
Well, they've already started working on a script for the next Star Trek film, the continuation from this one. No big surprise there. They know that they're going to make money on this. Between the Abrams fans, the Star Trek fans, and the general populace that they're trying to draw in, this is going to be a moneymaker for them. They are going to continue along in the Abrams universe for the foreseeable future. I have a couple of suspicions as to where the next movie may go. I would not be at all surprised if the bad guys in the new movie were the Klingons. Dealing specifically with some of the ramifications of Nero's attack on the Klingon fleet. I also wouldn't be surprised if it delved more into the relationship between Spock and Uhura, with Spock questioning whether he should continue this relationship or hook up with a good Vulcan girl to do his part in repopulating his species.
Think about it. Kirk-era Trek, Klingons, ridged foreheads. From everything we've ever known about Gene Roddenberry, do you really think making the Klingons look like stereotypical Asian villains from the 1930s would have been his first choice?
Not really.
We're kind of talking speculation. There's a lot open here. They could go with this is the vision of the positive universe, and the fact that the Klingons and the Federation have been decimated, this will bring them together sooner than the next generation. We're not going to have to wait 100 years for an alliance between the two. Going by that vein of thought, perhaps this could bring the Romulan and the Vulcan reunification. I mean, they are genetically similar. They're from a similar origin. This could be the answer to that also. Just as easily, you could see somebody like the Cardassians going, "Oh, the Federation and the Klingons are both weak. We are strong."
But no, what I want to know is things like, okay, if this movie is doing as well as I think it's doing, and I haven't seen the numbers or anything, it's getting good reviews. It's gotten the best reviews of any Star Trek movie I've ever seen.
That one with the whales, that had good reviews.
Granted, it had the whales and people are green. But what I want to know is, okay, if they're doing well and if it's making money for Paramount, Are we actually not going to have to wait another 10 years before we get Trek on TV? Will this get Trek on TV again sooner?
I think not, because they're going to see a wait between movies makes people hungry.
But we do have 45 plus years of Star Trek Prime that's out there that we all love. I don't expect everything to change in the way of fan productions, the books that are published. Yeah, there might be some comic books that'll come out from this. There's already been one, the prequel for the movie. But I do think that that 45-year Prime universe is going to continue through the books, through the fan productions, things of that nature. I don't think that this is going to wipe out everything that came before it. Another fear that I've read.
I agree with you, but I think what it is saying is, for the foreseeable future, canon is going to be set in the Abrams universe. That doesn't mean they can't still do books and comic books and fan productions or whatever in the Prime universe, but yeah. None of that's canon.
Never has been, really never will. Eras is going to stick with Universe Prime for the foreseeable future. Got no real reason to change it. But again, just because we're dedicated to telling stories in the Prime universe did not negate the fact that we enjoyed this one.
Oh, by the way, the third guy in the bar fight, that was Finnegan.
That makes so much more sense now.
So, to finish things up, let's talk ratings, gentlemen.
2 pens as an episode of Star Trek, 3 pens as a movie.
I concur. As an action flick, definitely 3 pens out of 4.
I will give it 3 parents out of 3. Marty, Sue, Jerry. I figure any Star Trek movie that both of your parents and my parent who can still watch movies all enjoy.
So what we're saying is the movie's good for baby boomers and the movie is good for Gen Xers.
That being said, we want to thank you for tuning in. Do you have an opinion? Do you think we're full of hot air? Or do you agree with us wholeheartedly?
Or both.
Drop us a line.
As always, we request your feedback. Please write jim@twerponline.net. We can also be found at MySpace, Facebook, and Zanga.
Twerpcast is a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions. Copyright 2009. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Beyond the rim of starlight, my love is lost in starflight.